Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What's up, dude? Good to see you.
How you doing, buddy? All right?
I'm all right. Let's just do a quick little level check
here.
I was last night DJing for Andy Taylor. Do you know Andy Taylor? Is there a connection there from Duran Duran Power?
Yeah.
Power Machine, all of that?
Aye.
What's the connection there with you guys? Yeah.
There's a connection, but it might be with Jules, probably Jules, my brother.
Yeah.
Why do you ask that?
I was just reading that there was like a connection between him and Gunn. I thought maybe he produced one of your records or something, because I know he did a couple of the Almighty albums, but maybe my information is incorrect.
No, he was involved in something or other, but I can't quite put my finger in it.
You know? We'll never know then.
Do you know what? I think it might have been a mix. I think he might have done a mix of one of the songs.
Right. There
like
you go.
In the day.
Yeah.
Probably from the Taking on the World. I'm sure he did a mix of something. God, I need to check that up, but it's been so long.
It's been so long, and there's been so many, you know, albums and tours. And didn't you just do that album that you just mentioned there in its entirety along with Dan Reed and FM?
No, we're about to do that.
That's about to happen.
Yeah, that's about to happen in December. Starts off in Bristol, I think, on the 8th.
How's sales for that going? They're looking good?
Yeah, I think it's looking great, yeah. I mean, the Barrowlands, we're finishing up in the Barrowlands.
Amazing.
On the 21st, the Saturday, the 21st, so that's the last show, and it's... that's an incredible venue to play, you know.
I've never played it. I've played the O2 and I've done the Cat House, but yeah. Just from the outside, it has this iconic classic look, doesn't it?
I know, it's quite deceiving, actually, because a lot of people think, God, what's in there?
And then you get inside and it's just this majestic.
It's just, it's just got
one of the oldest venues in Glasgow, is it?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the one that still remains, still standing. Yeah.
Whereabouts in Glasgow did you grow up?
Right there, right next to the Barlands.
Right there?
Yeah, at the East End.
Right.
And between the Barlands and Celtic Park. That's where I was sort of brought up. And that's where I was born, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because there was a hospital there, Duke Street Hospital, which is the longest street in the UK.
Is it really? There you go.
It may have just changed recently, though. There was one in Aberdeen, I think. It's just changed, but it's probably one of the longest. I was born in Duke Street Hospital, which then became a psychiatric unit for the criminally insane.
The criminally insane as well, not just the insane, but the criminally insane.
That's where I was kind of brought up.
And it was you, your brother. Have you got any other siblings?
Yeah, I've got brother Mario and my sister Carmen. I'm the baby.
Right.
And Jules was in the band.
Of course, yeah.
He's the oldest. The other two are in between.
And did you grow up with a kind of a Catholic presence in the household?
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
Obviously with Scotland and Italy combined.
Yeah. It's chapel every Sunday.
Right. And did you enjoy that part of your childhood? Was it something you got on with?
No. I mean, Jules himself, he was an altar boy. But then he got thrown out because in one sort of like Christmas Eve, he was holding the candles, and And I think it was like, it was midnight mass. That's what it was. It was midnight mass and he was falling asleep and he kind of singed the other altar boy in front of him.
Brilliant.
His hair went on fire. So the priest was like, get out and don't come back. Oh, I couldn't help it. I fell asleep.
When you're young, you get tired. Don't you? That's late for a young lad to be up.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But I know.
So your parents were kind of heavily into it, were they?
They were, I mean, like not heavily into it. But yeah, we kind of always sort of practiced it, you know, and yeah, growing up, you kind of, you were in that sort of, you know, in that environment and you just, you know, you took it and went with it, you know.
Was rock and roll accepted in the household? Oh, was it allowed, encouraged even? Yeah.
Oh, very much so. I mean,
were your folks into music? Did they have a lot of records?
They had their favorites, you know, like, you know, I always remember that, you know, the weekends and stuff like that. And my mum and dad just like have the radio on and they'd be listening to all these sort of old stations. But my mum was a massive Frank Sinatra fan. That's who she absolutely loved.
Right.
I loved his voice. And then my dad, he was a bit different. He loved a lot of sort of, what do you call it? He loved Tina Turner. There's a lot of sort of black artists that he absolutely loved.
He's a disco Fats boy,
Domino.
Was he?
He loved Fats Domino. He was a big Fats Domino fan. And you used to hear that, you know, like at the weekends and, you know, like Saturday mornings and it'd just be blaring. It'd be waking you up.
My freedom.
That's right. Oh, Blueberry Hill.
Amazing catalogue.
So you would hear all that sort of stuff coming. And then just like, I think that's what kind of, I always kind of put that down to me getting involved in music at the beginning, you know.
Because it was always there.
It's always there. He was always like a musical fan. My uncle, who's blind, used to play the accordion. Well, we've actually got some video footage of him actually playing recently, but he's kind of all over the place now. He's 86. His hearing's definitely gone.
Was he born blind?
No, he became blind at the age of 14, 15.
Right.
So he did... Yeah,
what, is it like an accident or just a health thing in him that switched?
Health thing, yeah, Matt. It was just like, I can, you know, I don't really normally talk to him about it, but, you know, he does say, like, you know, when he was in class, the teacher had actually asked him to say a word. It was on the blackboard, and he couldn't read it from a distance. And the teacher told him, well, come up a wee bit closer and closer, and then he kind of couldn't see it at all. He was like, no, I can't see anything here. And that's what he felt. That was the change in, you know, and his sight was...
What a heavy thing to deal with at that age.
Oh, I mean, incredible, especially having sight. That must be the most difficult thing, you know.
But, thanks, V.
Oh, lovely. Thanks.
Drinks and snacks.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that. That'll waken me up.
Cheers. I don't do coffee. It sends me into jittery hyper overdrive. But a nice fresh can of orange pop will do the job. So did he then, like, was he in the household with you guys?
Yeah. See, my dad, my dad had like six other siblings, you know, but we were the family, out of all those brothers and sisters, we were the family that had more children, you know, and we always kind of thought, oh, this is a bit weird that my dad is taking care of Monko and yet he's having to look after four of us as kids, you know, whereas his brothers and sisters only like had two children each, you know. But I think the real reason was because my uncle absolutely loved my dad and they were very, very close, you know, and he sort of wanted to look after him. So there was actually, instead of six of us, seven of us in the house in a one-bedroom house.
One bed, wow.
A one-bedroom house, yeah.
Those
were, you know, I've got incredible memories.
Oh, no doubt. Well, that's that thing, I think, with that kind of a living situation is it's all you know, first of all. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you go, oh, no, we're poor.
Yeah.
And then also there's a lot of community spirit, not just within the household, but within the neighborhoods, right? And it all
kind of feeds into
this closely, beautiful...
It's closely met. And
melting
it's like
pot of characters.
Never,
and
ever once did I think, you know, that this I felt like... You know, this house is like too small for us or anything like that. You know, it was like you just kind of got on with it and that was just like every day. And it was just like, I didn't know. I had some of the happiest memories were from that house, you know. And I think it was like in the, it was like early 80s, we got sort of, my mum managed to get a council house, four bedrooms. And that was like around about Christmas time. I remember saying to me, look, we're not, won't be able to afford like any Christmas presents this year, but we've got the house. And like, and you should have seen us going into that house. It was like, wow, this is incredible.
A palace. We've arrived.
You know? Yeah, yeah. Just like everybody's got, well, we obviously sharing rooms, but, you know, but it was just like, wow, this is unbelievable, incredible. And that was like, you know, like a big sort of Christmas present. You
yeah,
know?
No doubt, man.
Instead, well, in saying that, she did actually get me the Millennium Falcon as well. Just
what a year. What a year to remember. I never had older siblings, so I never had anybody kind of switching me on to the music that would become my own, as it were. Yeah. Obviously, you've got your parents. Was your older brother turning you on to
well,
rock
Jules,
and roll?
Jules and my sister as well, Carmen. They would have a lot of vinyl stuff that would be lying around. And I think that's why I kind of, I think musically I've, it's quite diverse in what I listen to, you know, it's, I can listen to anything pretty much. And I think that's probably came from growing up, you know, where Jules would have like a Black Sabbath album, an AC/DC album. Carmen would have like the ABBA Super Trooper album or, you know.
There's an exhibition on at the O2. Have you seen that?
No.
Yeah,
no.
There's an ABBA Super Trooper exhibition.
Seriously?
Yeah, at the O2. I think it starts like the 4th or 5th of December.
Seriously? Oh, yeah, I'll be doing this neck of the woods at that time anyway.
There you go.
Because, yeah, I'll be definitely going to that. But, yeah, I mean, I loved all sort of different genres and styles of music and appreciated it all, you know. And that, I think that's, you know, we'll listen from my dad's. Era listening to, you know, Fats Domino, Mum, Frank Sinatra and stuff like that.
I guess you learn an appreciation for classic songwriting, don't you? Just well, quality about, is the only genre
for me,
that
matters. It's all about the songs. Yeah. That's what it is. It's all about the songs. And, you know, that's so important for me.
Well, that's always been there with Gunn, I think, hasn't it? Is the songs first and foremost.
Yeah. Because they tend
good,
to...
hooky, catchy tunes.
I think that they tend to stand a wee bit longer and, you know, the in time, you know, it doesn't, you don't get bored with it, you know, and it's like, if you've got a really cool melody or a great chorus melody and stuff like that, and I think that's, for me, that's so important. That is so important, rather than having, like, a vibe of a song or, like, a great riff that runs through a song or...
Well, Smoke on the Water is a great example of a very boring song. It doesn't really get talked about a lot. The riff is obviously iconic, but the song is kind of a bit dull and a bit bloated and a bit drawn out because it is just, and that's kind of the whole crux of the I think. Anyway.
It's so true. I mean, listen, don't get me wrong. There's riffs that can actually make a song.
Yeah.
You know, like we just mentioned there, I'm trying to think, Lenny Kravitz one. That
Are you gonna go my way?
Although that is a rip off of an old I've just noticed that a couple of weeks ago actually, and it was another album I used to listen to that Jules had, which was the Long Live Rock and Roll album by Rainbow. Is it Rainbow? Aye, Rainbow.
Yeah.
But there's a track on it that starts and it's got this atmospheric section at the beginning and then it goes into the actual Are You Gonna Go My Way riff. I'm like,
ah, there you go.
That's clever.
Well, Weller did that, didn't he, with Taxman from the Beatles. Boom, 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 boom. What you give is what you get. I think music history is full of that.
I don't mind that. I think that's exactly...
Wear your influence on your sleeve.
Big team. Of course it is.
Who was the big influence on Gunn, say, with that first record when you're just starting out? What were you guys all listening to at that time?
I mean, I didn't have much say in the writing side of that because I was only 16 at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I came straight out of school. I went to work in Fazzy Brothers, which was an Italian delicatessen. I missed some of my O-levels because of...
Was Italian music around?
What do you mean? Like
in the household?
In the house? Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't remember the names of them, but the old school Italian singers.
The crooners.
My mum used to listen to. Yeah, definitely. And if my gran was around or my nonna would be around, she would be like, oh, get some of the music on. I'm like.
And they're singing in Italian, I presume, as well, right? Yeah.
Yeah. There's a guy called Gianni Morandi. That's
right.
He was like a famous sort of old crooner, like really handsome looking dude. But other dude, we actually got to play football against him.
Really?
Yeah.
And what was the occasion?
It was some charity gig.
Right.
A charity football match.
Yeah.
And this was at Stamford Bridge. And I remember telling my mum, and this, I'm going back, right? This is 90s. It's got to be the 90s. And I think it was like an Italian sort of football team made up of stars, you know, like, and it was a Stamford Bridge, but Chelsea hadn't just, you know, this was before Roman Abramovich. And my mum's like, oh, wow, you meet Gianni Morandi and got a picture taken with him. And she's like, I can't believe you're
swooning. Yeah.
And then apparently he gave me, his manager was there and stuff like that. And after the game, Jules and I were getting into trouble because we'd just like kicked him off the park, you know, but he was given as good as he got, you know what I mean? So we just like, you know, followed through as well, you know, but it was quite fun. It was a lot of good fun.
But yeah, so you're working in this delicatessen, fresh out of school. The band's already been around, what, a year or so they've been going at this point?
They've just signed to A&M Records. And
was that just off the back of their live shows? What was the interest there?
Management. There was a live shows, and there was also it was G&R management, Jerry and Rab, who kind of were looking for a band that were a rock band, other than the band that they had just signed. So basically, they wanted a rock band, a pop band, and some sort of like indie sort of pop band. This is like back. Late 80s. So there was Gunn. There was a band called Slide. I don't know if you've ever heard of them.
Slide,
yeah.
No.
They didn't really do much. They didn't, you know, they had an album out and I think it just kind of fell apart. And then there was Texas. So it was a three band that was in the, you know, in the stables, you know, under G&R management. And it was partly down to, you know, seeing the band performing live. But I think you know, they could mold, you know, like a rock band in those days. And I think
Jules... Yeah, there was the infrastructure, wasn't there, to Jules develop. Was, and
Jules and Mark at the time, the original singer, they were like, you know, they were hungry to experiment and hungry to get a deal because they'd been, Jules especially had been slogging it for years.
Yeah, they wanted to get a bit of money in their pocket,
from,
right?
Like, the, you know, God, I remember Jules just going down with like a fine fare trolley with a cabinet in it, going down to rehearsals in the snow and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I remember all these sort of things, how, you know, and my mum just like, oh, why don't you just get a proper, look at your cousins, look at this, and get a proper job. And he'd be like, no, this is what I want to do. So I get lucky because the band gets signed and the bass player decides to leave.
Why? Why would you? The minute there's a deal on the table, I'm out.
You know what?
It's not what I want.
Do you know what, Matt? I swear to God, I've asked him a million times. I still see him. It's Cammy. He's a lovely guy. So, why would you not? He goes, oh, I didn't know what I did. I just didn't want.
I guess that life just isn't for some people, is it? The touring and the.
I don't know. I think he thought it was kind of gut wrenching. You know, like he couldn't deal with the stress of it all, I think. And I think deep down his worries were like, going into the studio to record, and I think he would have found it quite difficult, especially with Jules, you know, doing your neck, like getting you to play.
Is he a formidable dude? Is he?
Jules, I can be sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, in those days, it's reverse now. You know, it's me telling him what to do.
I love it.
But I was only 16.
And were you playing an instrument? Like,
I was playing guitar. I never played bass in my life.
Right.
I never played.
But you were proficient, you felt.
Oh, I remember sitting in the stairs of this house, of our new house,
mm-hmm.
and And he gives me acoustic guitar. He goes, like, can you play this in, you know, on the acoustic? And I went, and it was the bass riff of Girls in Love, which is off Taking on the World album. And I went, yeah, I can play it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, can you play this other one? And he tells me another song. And I play it. And he's like, oh, yeah, okay. I'm like, why are you showing me these songs? He goes, well, because, like, you know, Cammy's left. I goes, oh, I know that. And he goes, well, we're looking for a bass player. And we're thinking about you. And I'm like, me? No, I can't do that. No chance. No, I'm not doing that. I don't have the ball to do that. No chance. And, like, and I swear to God, that's how it was like. You know, I was like, really? And then I kind of thought about it. I'm like, maybe I could do it in the studio. I feel comfortable, but I wouldn't be able to do it live. I don't think I could perform in front of people live. I'd be too nervous, you know.
And there's no second takes, is there, live?
No, exactly. Yeah. You're just like, I'm just completely shitting myself. I was like, no, I don't want to do that. And it came to the point where the managers came up to the house to ask my mum, look, Dante is going to be, you know, we want to, you know, nurture him and you know, we'll show him the ropes and stuff like that. The band have got an album coming out. He doesn't have to play bass guitar on the album. We're not expected to play bass guitar on the album. But he's going to walk straight into a job where he's going to be paid, you know, a weekly set of 70 quid, I think it was, a week.
A 16-year-old.
Back in 1989, that was no bad.
That's solid wage.
Yeah, that's like 300-400 quid,
yeah,
you know, in present day. But yeah, that was like, and then it's like my mum was like, right, you should definitely do it. You should definitely do it. You're going to get to see the world. You're going to do this and do that. And I was like, right, okay, then here goes. So I would work in Fadzie Brothers like from like 8 in the morning till 5 o'clock at night. And then after that, I'd go straight to rehearsals. And that happened for like a few months to do that because we were preparing me for, it was, what do you call it? We were doing showcases.
Yeah.
For different...
All
for
over public. The UK, yeah. Or just Glasgow?
No, it was just in Glasgow. We had, not record labels, but because we were already signed, but it was publishing companies and stuff like that were really interested in seeing the band. And I was just like, God, dead nervous, you know? But I worked my ass off for it, you know? And I put in the hours. And then I did my first gig, my very first gig. And it was like... just the way it is now, like first two or three songs, you're kind of butterflies in your tummy and you're just
finding
nervous.
Your feet.
And then just like,
it clicks and you're
just like,
right there.
You know, I'm not coming off this stage.
Yeah.
You know,
you need it's funny like that, isn't it? Because the adrenaline's just so high, it's such a blur. And then, as you say, the minute you get off, you just want to get straight back on and do it again. Totally. But it's like, it's over.
It's the high, Matt, that you get after the gig as well. And it's like, God. It just takes forever to come down, especially if it's a cracking gig, you know, or even those gigs where you've just got like a neutral sort of audience that aren't kind of totally receptive, that, you know, that may have not heard of you before, maybe like in a festival situation. And by the end of it, you've won them over.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lovely feeling. It's a great feeling, you know. No, good.
What was the first song off that first album which took off for you, Better Days? Was that the one that became the launch single,
Better
as
Days.
It were? Yeah.
Yeah, Better Days was like, that was funny though, because it didn't sound, I remember being in the studio and we were like recording it and I thought to myself, this is me kind of, it was just kind of a basic sort of beat. And you're talking about like, what, you know, what sort of music were you inspired with at the time? Well, it was like Prince. We just loved the Prince. I think the Parade album was just out at that time. And there was a song off it called Mountains. And we nicked, not the music of it, but the way the drums kind of, they were like doing sort of delayed sort of drum beats. It's like that. That's how Mountains sounds like. And I was like... And Kenny, the producer, goes, we should try and recreate this. We should try and recreate that for Better Days, you know, because it'll make it, you know, a lot smoother. It'll just like, especially if you're doing 16s in the bass, you know, it's just, it'll sound a lot groovier,
yeah.
You know, and a wee bit different. We've still got the hard edge of the song, the melody's quite hard, you know, but and the guitars will be, you know, toughened. But I think we should really go with this sort of groove. And we're like, okay, how long is that going to take to do that? Because in those days, I remember in like 1989, it was like all done on sort of tape.
Yeah, of course.
It was like analog tape. So that took forever.
No garage band then.
That took forever to do delayed drums like that, you know. So we went away, Jules and I went away upstairs for a couple of hours, just waiting. And then Kenny comes running upstairs, like, oh, you need to hear this, have a listen to this, see what you think. And honest to God, he sat down, he played, it's just the backing track, it wasn't the vocals or anything, it was just the backing track. And that way, the hairs and your arms just stand on end as soon as you hear it back. I thought,
you knew you had something special right away.
This is something really special. If we get the melody right here, the vocal right on it, this is going to be huge. This is a bit different. And it's it was a bit different from what other rock bands were doing at the time, you know. And I think that was what part of the reason that was our manager was kind of instilling in us. Try not to, you know, you've got the background of listening to bands like Zeppelin, AC/DC, Bowie, and Black Sabbath and Rainbow. All these sort of rock, you've got that, but listen to something that's a wee bit different and something that's more current that will maybe open up other doors for you rather than just sticking to that genre of music, because you don't want to just sound like another cliche of those bands. And
is that something that stayed with
and that's something that's
your songwriting approach?
Yeah, totally.
Ever since.
But then, as I said to you, Matt, for me, that I welcomed that with open arms, because I was listening to stuff, as I said, as diverse from ABBA to AC/DC when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So that kind of welcomed that sort of vibe, you know. But
how far up the single charts did that song climb?
Oh, that, you know what? It was and considering it was still perceived as a big hit, and it went to 32 or 33.
But I guess in those days, singles sold that much more, didn't they?
Do you know what? I think, yeah. I think from,
like, to get a top 40 now, you sell a couple of thousand records.
I don't know
if
it did that. I've kind of started at 60, then it went to 42, and then it went to 33. That's how songs kind of went into the charts.
Yeah.
In those days.
Especially from a brand new, for the,
and then 33,
all intents and purposes, unheard band.
Maybe it was 38, the third, fourth. So it kind of just, it was a good, and Radio 1 was just like totally all over it, you know, and it was like, this was all new to us. I mean, we didn't expect anything. Like, I mean, I'm saying with like Bare Days, I didn't expect it to get that sort of.
You knew it was special, but.
Knew it was special, but you
didn't know it was going to get you in.
Your first album, man. You don't. You
in the door.
You don't have anything.
Yeah.
Any sort of.
Comparison at all.
Comparison to it, you know. You have the ambition, but it was. That was amazing. And then because of that, that kind of took off in Europe. And one of the places was like Spain was huge for us, you know, which was like bizarre. I don't know how that, well, I do know how that happened. There was a woman that was working for the label and who believed in the band as much as we believed in it and as much as your label in the UK believed in it. And they like, and she goes, I remember her meeting up with her because we did this whole tour of Europe where it was just like promo tour.
So you're just doing interviews, you're not playing shows?
I'm not doing interviews, maybe a couple of acoustic things.
Yeah,
like
in stores or something,
but,
yeah.
Aye, but,
or radio.
And you'd hear the same stuff from all the different territories. It's like, we'll see what we can do, And then we eventually get to Spain, and this amazing woman, Lydia, and she was like, and we're like that to her. Lydia, please save your breath, because we've heard this from all the other regions, mm-hmm. You know, like Denmark, Holland, they say the same stuff. She goes, I guarantee you, the next time you play here, you come to Spain, you will be playing to 2,000 people. And then Jules and I, messing ourselves. Oh, God.
Sure enough, it came true.
Aye. But don't get me wrong, it was a lot of hard work up until
of
that
course,
point,
laying the foundations.
It was like, you know, it was shitloads of radio stuff that we did, TV stuff, you know, and she really worked her ass off on it, and bless her, you know, that's what kind of helped us with that sort of tour, with, you know, that country. Spain was brilliant. And then in turn, Portugal was amazing as well. Kind of followed suit.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You don't really associate, because I've been to those countries a lot, and well, nowadays anyway, yeah. Italy, Portugal, Spain. You don't see a lot of gigs advertised for rock bands in those countries. Yeah. Germany, France, yeah. Scandinavia, yeah. But with those three,
yeah,
it doesn't seem to be as...
It's probably not.
Infiltrated, if you will, by American and British guitar music and pop.
That's what I love about, like, when you do shows in Spain and Portugal and stuff like that, the tickets can be quite expensive. And it's funny, because I always kind of look at it as when somebody goes to a show in Spain or, you know, comes to a show in Madrid or Barcelona, the tickets are expensive. So they spend money on the ticket and they go there to enjoy themselves.
So they're in it, in the moment.
Yeah, they go there to enjoy. I mean, in Madrid, Madrid and Glasgow is like on a par with each other.
Really?
Yeah.
What, just for kind of rabid reaction?
The atmosphere and the vibe. And then you've got like a total foreign language, people singing every song.
Yeah.
You know, that's just bizarre, you know. But that's what I'm saying. People have spent, you know, whatever, €30 to go and see a band. I'm going to go and enjoy myself. Whereas I think in the UK, it can be kind of, you know, like
I've spent 30 quid,
so impress me.
You know? Arms folded.
I want to, you know, be impressed. I've spent 30 quid. So it's a different way of thinking, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Spain. I love touring Spain. I love, you know, going to Portugal and stuff like that as well. And Germany was a really big market for the band as well. And that came later on with, like, the Swagger album.
Yeah, and Word Up.
Word Up.
That's another, you know, you're pulling from R&B again.
Yeah, well, that
with
was...
that one. Was that always on the cards, or was how no, did that... that did you a, need to just fill the albums, like, no, this, track listing up?
This had came off of... This was a B-side.
Okay.
It was a B-side right. off the Gallus.
Which you just recorded for a bit of fun.
Off the Gallus album. We did, I can't remember what the last single off the Gallus album was. But anyway, the record came on, like, oh, he's trying to do another cover for the B-side. I'm like, right, okay then. Well, we'd been jamming this one live. I think we'd been playing it live, actually, Word Up. I thought, well, we'll just do Word Up. Re-record that. And we went in with Chris Sheldon, and he produced it. And we just had a laugh doing it. And it was great fun. And then sort of, right, there's a B-side. And the record company heard it and they went, no, that's not a B-side. That's a single. We're keeping that for the next album. Like, what? No, that is killer. What a cover version that is.
It is fucking great.
No, but that's
because Korn had a go at it as well.
And yeah,
I think yours is easily the superior of those two.
Won the MTV
it's maybe
Award
even better than the original. Dare I say
it? This is the funny thing, Matt. There's some kids out there that I've bumped into, and they're like, ah. Is it not your song?
Yeah.
I think, like, what? Our song? No, it's Cameo. who's Cameo?
Yeah.
Oh, you're taking a piss. Come on. And I swear to God, that's, I don't know how many times that's actually happened to me, you know, with people saying that, but it's, that's hilarious. And
what was the MTV award you won? Best cover?
Best cover best version. Cover, yeah. It was us. I can remember. Well, there's three. It was Ace of Base. I don't know.
Rescue Me. Is that what they did?
No. Who else was it? Wait.
Right.
Yeah. Love Is All Around.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they should have got it because
that was the song that was at number one for like half a year, wasn't it? I feel it just over and over again.
I feel the drugs.
So you beat them.
Aye.
Have a bit of that.
I can't remember it that way. Like,
who else was at the award ceremony? Any heroes and stars of yours?
You two are in front of us.
Just sat right there.
Sat in front of us. Sting. The right. Prince is on stage performing. Prince. Who's my idol?
Yeah, you know, what Prince's, a night. Did you speak to him? Did you say
Steve Tyler was there? No, I didn't go up to Prince. I didn't. Somebody asked me that recently.
Is he somebody who's surrounded by a bit of an entourage? Is he a bit of an unapproachable?
Because he was my idol, and I was disappointed. So scared if he came across as somebody that wasn't that nice, then I would fall out of love, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Music, you know. I just thought, no, I'll just keep him in awe of that. I want to just be like, worship him the way I've got in my head, you know, rather than bring it back down to earth by him.
Well, he's almost superhuman, wasn't he?
He was still incredible, alive. Incredible. But Steve Tyler went straight up. He was there. And
he seems like he's, although Jules, he's a massive rock star, like, a lot more approachable.
Jules is like, I'm going to go and get that get an autograph. And it was for her, I think it was for nephew or somebody. I'm like, I need bother. I went right up to Steve Tyler. He was nice. But I had been drinking from 9 o'clock in the morning. Because at that point, I hated flying. I didn't like flying in planes.
Right. So that would be how you get over
too many
it.
Bad experiences flying. And so I just, we flew club class and British Airways, and it's like, and I remember the stewardess, God, she's like, surely not club class. And I'm like, yes. And then see the re-steward button, that the stewardess button, that kept getting pressed, you know, the waitress button, that kept getting pressed. More champagne, please, more champagne. So anyway, when I got there, I just continued to drink throughout the night. So it was a bit of a blur winning the award. And I remember actually turning up being a bit gassed, and Ace of Base were behind me because obviously they were nominated for the same award. And I'm like, sorry for you guys. I'm really sorry. And I was being genuine, and I think they were like, because they're Swedish, I think he is.
Yeah.
And they were like, they just
lost in translation.
Do you know what I mean? Because we picked up the award. But that night, God. And that was another incident. Me and Ian Asprey pissing in the pavement in Brandenburg Gate. Just at Brandenburg Gate. That was hilarious as well, too. It was wrecked. Well, I was wrecked. I don't know about him. He was just following suit. He was following me. That was funny. Because we'd been touring with... Well, we didn't tour. We bumped into them in festivals and stuff like that. And Ian Asprey's always like, you know, oh, you're up in Glasgow. And yeah, I lived in Glasgow. And
is he a good dude?
Aye, a brilliant dude. Aye. I mean, he's, you know, he'd lost his way, you know, but I think he's back on track now. But no, I was in the time of... In those days, it was just mental, but it was a good laugh. It was really good fun.
How was the Stones tour?
That was just surreal.
Which cycle were they on?
What do you mean?
Like album?
They did Urban Jungle tour.
Okay. So what was the stage show like? What was the design?
It was.
Is it crazy?
You know, not like the way it is now, when you see it now, but it was the inflatables. That was their thing. It was the massive inflatables, you know. But it was good fun. That lesson that I probably didn't appreciate it as much as I should have at the time, because I was only like 18 or 19, you know, and I was like, But I remember we were in the middle of this shithole tour, in America. Oh my God, it was the worst ever. You know,
your own headline tour.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But, I mean, don't get me wrong. Certain shows were busy. You know, like if you went to the big cities and stuff like that. We played the Troubadour in LA.
Yeah, yeah.
And because we had to cut the tour short, because that's when we got the call from Jagger.
Right. And you were like, yeah, get us off this tour and we'll jump on with the Stones.
Jagger had sent a fax through your manager. Manager sent it through your tour manager. I was sharing the name with him. And I think we were in Texas, somewhere in Texas. And he goes, I think you have just been offered the Stones tour. I'm like, what? Because we had heard rumours, but there was like 60 or 70 other bands that were getting touted for it. You know, and remembering the previous bands that toured with them, like Prince and all that sort of stuff, it was like, God, that would have been this would be incredible if we get this. But we did. We got it. And it was Jagger. It was down to Jagger. He was the one that picked us.
What song had he heard? Did he tell you?
I don't know. He must have heard the album, but apparently that's what they do. They kind of, well, he did. At the time, we kind of checked out all the video footage, all the songs and stuff like that. And
handpicked them himself.
Aye. And then I did, you know, I mean, I see this story so many times, but for those people listening to Matt's podcast, but, you know, they haven't heard this story, but, you know, I remember going up to him. We were in a club in Berlin, and I went up to him and goes, all the bands, mate, why did you pick us? He goes, like, you reminded me of us when we first started out. And I thought, wow, that's fucking amazing, man. Because we were really hungry. They sent faxes to all these different bands. Faxes to other, you know. And they asked us what we needed for the tour. And other bands must have been sending stuff like, you know, we need that such and such a rider. We need this amount of stage sound. You know, cabinets, etc. We just sent a fax, just massive rain. We'll take whatever you can give us.
Really, I love it.
Right, that's.
They must have saw that and chuckled.
He must have done that. That's it. That's a band. You know, that was it. That was true. You know, that was just incredible.
I imagine that elevates your game as a performer and as a live unit.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Well,
big time.
Because of that tour getting cut short, we had to. There was like in Troubadour, it was meant to be two nights. It was one for the fans and one for all the record company and press and stuff like that. It was like a showcase one. So we had to cut. We had to like cancel a night and make one a matinee, one an evening sort of thing, you know, so that we could get back to, I think Rotterdam was the opening, Rotterdam Stadium.
Was that a high pressure,
oh, big time,
tense moment, that first show?
You're jet lagged, buggery, you know. Yeah. It's like
terrified.
Oh my God. You're shattered. You're like from playing to like 300-400 capacities straight in to playing to 50,000-60,000 people. And it's like, what? This is surreal.
How many seats were like on bums when you guys went on stage? It was full.
It was full.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is unbelievable. I don't know if we had played Wembley Stadium previous to that. I think we might have done with Simple Minds, because we did do that a couple of times. But we did three times, the old Wembley Stadium with the Stones, once with Simple Minds. I don't know if that was previous. So that was like my first big sort of show to play in front of. But it wasn't the biggest, though. No, that was a funny thing. The biggest one that we played to was in Valencia, which was like 250,000, without a lie, 250,000 people. It was a free concert, and it was to mark the start of the summer. And it was a huge stretch of motorway. It was just massive, as far as the eye could see. And we went on at like 1 a.m. And
wow. Everyone's just cooked, are they?
Oh my God. It was unbelievable, man. I was just like, this is incredible. And it was like their version of like Radio 1. It was like 40 Principalis. So that's what the name of the radio station is. It's a huge, big station. But that was unreal. just a sea of heads. It's like,
yeah, you can't even visualize that.
It's just, but you end up, I don't
even
know.
Even 50,000, you struggle to wrap your head around that, but five times that.
I felt comforting in some way that it's like, just treat it as like just a sea of people.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for a fact that nobody's going to be able to hear you all the way back. But it was unbelievable. What a feeling that was. That was incredible.
Is that the best tour you'd say you'd done up until that point?
Oh, what was
the Stones, and then what came after? Like in terms of like big, didn't you do like a Def Leppard or a Bon Jovi?
Yeah, we did Def Leppard and Bon Jovi.
Oh, together?
Not together. No. Def Leppard tour was great, but it was a bit weird because it was in the round, and that was hilarious. In fact, that was hilarious actually because it started off in Dublin, and they did like 3 days pre-production in Dublin. And we obviously couldn't afford the radio packs that they've got. They're like $2,000 a piece, their packs. But we had to get them. We had to buy them because in order to use it, because you're running from one side of the stage to the other, and you know, you need to communicate, or you need to, you know, interact with the audience.
Hold it together somehow, yeah.
Interact with the audience. But so we went to Tandy. Remember Tandy, the shop? The electrical shop. And we got four radio packs and transmitters and stuff like that for like, I think it was 200 quid or something like that. And the day after, after the first show, main gig, they've got, and then they started to get interference in their transmitters, right? They were getting cab calls and ambulances and stuff like that. And definitely, going on here, because it's all American crew that they had as well, and like, hey guys, where did you get your transmitters, radio packs and stuff? Oh, Tandy, just where'd they come in Tandy? It's like, these are $2,000 a piece, these things. And I'm like, oh my god, no, we didn't pay that much for it. It's only 200 quid, mate, for us, for all four of them. But it was hilarious. But that was a really weird gig to do. Playing in the round is a strange one.
Yeah, especially for the support act.
Because you're performing and you're like, right, have we spent enough time at this side? Should go back? You're thinking, right, I better go around, turn around. And it's like...
It's a weird one, isn't it? It's a weird one.
I've seen Prince in the round. That was... I mean, don't get me wrong. I think it is a great sort of... if it works. Because I think the audience feel they're closer to the band.
Yeah.
If it's in the round as well. You know, and I think, no, it does work. You know, especially in this day and age, I'm sure they've got sort of better means of, you know, the electronic stuff.
£50 yeah, radio sets interfering with the headliner's gear.
Matt.
I love it. They forgave you, though. They were cool with it.
Oh, no, totally. No. They were totally fine. And then I think, you know, the drummer, I forget the drummer's name, but I remember the riser that just kind of went up. I mean, it was pure Spinal Tap at times. Even, you know, Joe Elliott would admit to that. But the goes up to the ceiling, and it was a point, Dublin point. And the drum riser goes right away up to the ceiling, and it doesn't come back down. And it's stuck up there. The hydraulics are knackered or something, yeah. I don't know. And I was like, oh my God. They're probably glad that this is the first night of the tour. And oh my God, I think a lot of people got sacked after that show. You know, but it was hilarious.
Get the drummer down.
It was Spinal Tap. It was total Spinal Tap. But great tour, though. Great guys.
Well, I've been given the sign, so we're going to need to wrap, but I guess we just should do a kind of crass segue and leap right forward. So you've got this triple header tour with Dan Reed and FM coming up.
Yeah.
And what about 2020? What's on the cards?
Well, we're looking at bringing out a new album next year at some point. We're still working on that just now. But we've got this new album coming out just now to mark the 30th anniversary of Taking on the World. So that's got like the sort of all the singles.
Yeah. 30 years is crazy, isn't it?
Oh no, don't start me. 10 singles we've got from that. And then we've done, we've got 10 cover versions. Some of them we've obviously like Word Up and it's in there as well. But we've done another few more new ones which sound
will you be good. Playing some covers at the shows other than Word Up?
No, we can.
No?
Because we
contractually obliged, are you, to just
no,
do
no,
the
No, we don't have enough time. Because I think, well, it's Dan Reed, FM, and ourselves, and we're all playing an hour each. So
are you rotating the bill, are you, each day?
There's 10 nights. I think we're all taking three, you know, well, we get four because of the balance. I'm sure it'll be good fun, you know. But yeah, we're playing and taking on the world in its entirety. And obviously Dan Reed are doing the same with Slam, and FM are doing the same with their album as well. But yeah, they get Tough It Out, I think that's it. That's their album that they're playing. So we're all playing these three iconic albums from 30 years ago.
Yeah, great package, Bill.
I'm really looking forward to it. Playing these songs for the first time in a long time is going to be a bit...
Well, some of them are getting played for the first time ever in some cases.
No, every
song on the album has had a live outing at some point before.
Yeah, Matt. But like once...
Some of them haven't been played for a long 30 years.
Yeah. But it's good to know that we've actually... We've not started rehearsals
really?
Yet now.
I love it.
No, we'll do it. A couple
fine.
Of days.
You're
we'll
a well-oiled
machine.
Well,
we do six songs anyway off Taking on the World.
Right. That's just part of the live show kind of staples.
Yeah. And then we'll do, you know, there's four more songs, but we'll get there with it.
Easy.
No, definitely, Matt.
We'll come back on again, mate, when the new record's out. We'll get into all the rest of it because there's loads of other stuff I want to chat to you about. But thanks for coming on, mate.
Cheers,
enjoyed
Matt.
It.
Thanks very much, man.
Cheers, buddy.
Cheers.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.